All right. Well, Scott asked me to come in today. My name's Kelly Wallace. I'm an attorney here in Atlanta with Wellborn Wallace and Woodard. We're a very small law firm with a civil practice with an internet specialty. Very small. It's Mr. Wellborn. I'm Mr. Wallace, and somebody I went to law school with is Mr. Woodard. So, we have a pretty big record of judgments, mostly on behalf of Earthlink, but also some other ISPs against folks, mostly in the anti-spam area, but also that typically borders on a lot of the internet fraud and crime and that comes along. And Scott's asked me to come in today to talk to you about botnets. I don't really know what's the level of the room here. If I have to go talk to my mom about botnets, it's a very different conversation than if I talk to folks from. I'm a tech alumni, so if I talk to people like that, they typically know what we're talking about. Does everybody know what a botnet is? They may not know what a botnet is. All right. Well, good. I wrote some stuff down. It's good use of my time. Basically, a botnet. First, what's a bot or a zombie, as they're known? And what these are typically is these are compromised. These are infected computers that typically are on always-on internet connections. So home, high-speed internet, business computers, and that. They get a thing called a bot or a zombie program on them, which combines all the worst aspects of other kinds of malicious software or malware, and it basically lets someone else take control of that computer surreptitiously and use it to do bad things. And there's any range of bad things that botnets do. I've encountered some of them in my practice. There are others that I've, recently read up on and thought, wow, that's awful. I hope that's not going on anywhere that I have anything to do with. A lot of botnets are out there sending all that delicious spam that we get in our mailboxes all the time. And these botnets can also, can also be put to some pretty, spam is bad, don't get me wrong, but it's not the most malicious use that a botnet can be put into. When you see in the news, there was one very recently about internet attack or denial of service attack, often called a DDoS attack. Those are almost always these days committed by botnets, because what they are is they allow these attacks to come from hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of separate infected computers, which makes it very, very hard to deal with at the point where the attack is actually happening. Most of what can be done about botnets, as far as disabling them or disrupting them, you really need to be doing sort of proactively. You need to be finding command and control and neutralizing that before they're put into motion. Once the bots get their marching orders, you're then really relying on things like real-time blacklists and that to shut down into independent sites of bad traffic. So that's probably a big overview of the stuff I have. There's somebody that I consulted with that I always go to whenever I have any sort of malware issue, who's here in Atlanta, and I was trying to get him to come along, named Lawrence Baldwin. I don't know if anybody knows Lawrence. Minet Watchman is his business. And he is he's scary. He basically runs a botnet zoo up in Alpharetta. He's got a huge network of PCs that he's cobbled together. And whenever he finds a new piece of bad software out there, he goes and gets a copy of it and infects a machine and then locks it up and watches what it does. And I know he's worked on some of the cases that I've been involved in, both with civil litigation as well as with law enforcement, in really trying to track down and find the upstream things, the command and control computers, and in some cases we've had some luck with folks even pointing us to the people that likely set up and or operate the botnets. The bad news is, unfortunately, those people are rarely within the geographic boundaries of the United States, so they're typically outside the range of either the civil litigation process or, more importantly, law enforcement. I guess that's a good 10,000 foot view of botnets. I said to Scott, right? Yeah. I said to Scott right before we started, you know, there's a lot. I'm talking tomorrow about spam, and I can tell you right now, there's a lot more that as a civil attorney I can do about spam than I can do about botnets. Typically, when we see one, if it's a spam-related one, you know, we kind of detach the spam part from the botnet part, and the botnet part gets handed over either to the abuse department at whoever we're working with, or we call the FBI guys that we work with, and we say, hey, you might want to look into this place, or you might want to hand it to Lawrence, or he's already tracked back command and control to, I can't think of the one in Florida, but, you know, the Planet. There's a whole bunch of them in San Jose. Mycolo, and then there was the one that they shut down just recently in San Jose that are really bad, and then it's more or less out of our hands. But they could be really. So, does anybody have any questions? I'd be happy to answer questions.
How many do you think are from quote bad guys, and how many do you think are from more starting to get like government sponsored?
I think they're all bad guys. I mean, I think it's all the same bad guys. I mean, I don't think that. Yes, we're seeing. You know, I read the DHS reports too. So, yes, we're seeing a lot of Chinese, Korean, Russian.
I guess I should have been more like script kiddies versus more heavy duty ones.
Well, I think the script kiddie ones, there are probably a ton of them. If you're talking about just different flavors, yeah, I mean, the script kiddies probably outweigh everybody else. But in terms of compromised machines and actual effectiveness, you're looking at some serious heavy hitters running, you know, 10 or 12 botnets versus the hundreds or thousands of amateurs that are out there trying to put their own together. We're also seeing, I was talking to Lawrence this week, and he's also started to see... what's the name of it? There's a Kubeface, which as of end of July, Network World was ranking as the number two bad botnet in the United States with approximately 3 million in bot members. 3.6 is number one, so at least according to Network World. Kubeface has some modularity to it, so that the people who run it can, you know, it needs to send spam, or so I'm going to put a spam module out and distribute it to all the bots, and then they're going to be spam bots. Or it needs to do key logging, so I'm going to send out a key logging module, and now they're going to be doing key logging. There's an uninstall module now that's going out and saying, oh, this machine that it's been installed on, I see Zeus. Bye-bye, Zeus. Now it's a Kubeface machine. So the botnets are actually starting to cannibalize one another, which is good that they're uninstalling themselves. They're uninstalling each other, but they're not uninstalling themselves at the end of the process. So what you may end up with is the survival of the fittest in a few months or years, where you've got two botnets and they each have, you know, tens of millions of machines. So
along the same line, since there are people who can find botnets and then take them over, why can't we write software that does the same thing? And then shuts them off.
Well,
and stops
it. And that's what a lot of the researchers are doing. I know UC Santa Barbara, UC Santa Cruz. There's an academic paper that's out there that's available on the internet where they got into Torpig, which is a big one of the top 10 in the United States. And they infected a machine and they isolated it. And they sat down and watched it and started tracking it. Oh, that's you. Let me turn this on. They infected the machine and then they watched it to see what it did, to see where its command and control were coming and going from. And, that and some other things led to some other investigators, and this is what Lawrence does when we work with him and when he works with other academic groups in the FBI, is really the thing you look for is shutting down the control. Ethically, the right thing to do is to shut down the control. You know those are bad computers. You know those are computers being run and maintained by people that are actually running the botnet. Now, as far as uninstalling it goes, you know, that raises a sort of ethical question. If you're my mom and, you know, you're 74 years old and you've got a notebook and you click on anything that comes to you in email and you end up with a compromised machine, well, certainly it was illegal for the bad guy to put that on our machine. Is it illegal for the good guy to come in and without telling her clean it up? I mean, it's a public service. I mean, you know, if somebody dumps trash on your lawn, that's trespassing. And if somebody else comes along and walks onto your lawn to pick it up, that's also trespassing. Now, you're not going to prosecute it in most cases. Right. You're not going to get a lot of complaints, but, you know, I'm a lawyer. I hate other lawyers. Don't get me wrong. We're a litigious society. You're not going to get a lot of complaints, but there's going to be that one guy out there who sues you for going on his machine without his permission, and, you know, you might have stumbled across his special picture file or something that he didn't want known about. So, yeah.
I work at Georgia Tech.
Uh-huh.
And the Georgia Tech Information Security Center operates a project that steals command and control for botnets. And then all the academics get in and research how they work and how they talk to each other. That creates a little bit of a problem of itself, because every once in a while we'll get a call from the government saying, please shut down your command and control because you're running our government site. And we have to tell them that if we turn it off, the real guys will get you. Because as soon as we turn it off, it phones home to the next server on the list.
Right.
So as long as they're talking to us, they're not talking to the real bad guys. We capture botnets typically between 1 and 2 million machines.
Yeah. Do you know Lawrence? Lawrence Baldwin? I know,
yes.
He was.
Yes, yeah, I know
that's
Lawrence.
That's Lawrence. There,
yeah, do you know David Dagan?
No.
He's
not. Haven't met him.
I've
heard the name through Lawrence, but Lawrence and I spent an awful 2 weeks. He was an expert witness for a case of mine in North Fargo, North Dakota last year about this time. So
that's a bad place to go this time.
It's a bad time to sit around for 2 weeks on a case. So
In fact, our whole campus was taken down about a week ago because somebody broke into one machine, started doing something on an IRC channel that ticked off a botnet operator, and 1.8 million machines hammered our box with SSH brute forces, and it took down the firewall because the connection table couldn't keep up with the number of states. So we had to shun the machine and eventually got our net back. But to take down an entire campus because one botnet came after one machine, that's a tactical weapon.
Well, and I imagine it's particularly bad with universities with the amount of IRC usage. I mean, you guys probably allowed IRC usage forever anyway. You never blocked it off like companies can do and just tell their employees,
really,
no IRC.
No.
And now they're talking about the new one is Twitter, is using Twitter or what's the other one? The one that starts with an R. These Twitter-like sites to use those as command and control channels, very robust, very redundant command and control channels, which a lot of businesses are going to be reluctant to turn off, you know, to block that at the firewall. I mean, they can block IRC because, you know, there's not a lot of legitimate traffic you need to be using it with a lot of places, but I imagine universities are with the student access.
Yeah, we pretty much can't turn anything off.
Yeah, you can't turn anything off. So, somebody else?
Is constructing a botnet inherently illegal? For example, if I created a software product and attached a botnet to it, and in the EULA said this installs a botnet, and used it for non-malicious purposes, is that breaking the law?
Well, there's a variety of issues there. You know, when you install software and you've got a user agreement, an end user license, or whatever it is. You know, courts go back and forth on how enforceable every last line in an end-user license is. It used to be, you know, clickware versus shrink, click licensing versus shrink wrap licensing versus how much consent did the user have to give. And, you know, the consumer protection people, I think, thankfully, have been winning this. And, you know, hiding, you know, if you have a program that does one thing and you're installing a bot, even if you're not using it for malicious purposes, I think you're running a risk. I think you're, you know, if I download the newest video game and it also has a friendly bot that is only used for good things on it, and that's not in, you know, 10-foot-high flaming letters on a license somewhere, you're running a risk. I mean, and honestly, for those of you who don't work with lawyers much, and hopefully nobody does have to, you know, what we do in the civil world, we balance risk. You know, it's all about, you know, you can be sued by anybody for anything, and it's just minimizing that for most people. And I would, if you were my client, no, don't do that. Don't do that without expressly telling a client. Now, there's things like SETI at home, if people know what SETI at home is, you know, that's sort of like a botnet. You know, that's doing some stuff with your computer when you're not using those CPU cycles. But you agree expressly that they can do it, and they're telling you what they can do, and presumably you can tell them to stop at any point, and they will do so, which is not the typical case with the botnet, where you don't even know what's happening. So,
it's also considered extremely bad form to do that, and there's been quite a number of companies, really big ones, like, I won't mention their name, Sony, who installed a rootkit with some of their software and got in a lot of hot water.
Yeah. Anybody else have anything? Let's see if I have anything new. I was excited about the uninstalling.
I got a question for you.
I got a question for you.
Okay. So what's the revenue stream like for these botnets, for the larger networks? How much money are they producing?
It's really hard to know. It's actually really cheap to rent them. The first one, real one we ran into in civil litigation, it was being used to spam adult sites, and we did what we always do in a spam investigation. And you, my best friend is a starving artist, and he's my investigator. And he got to buy several thousand adult website subscriptions, and then we get his credit card statements. And we follow the money. We see where the money goes, and eventually someone squeals. And we found a spammer. It was an affiliate program that was not really an affiliate program. It was sending all its own mail. It wasn't using actual affiliates. And they had bought access to a Russian-operated botnet. And if you could not Google this thing, you could not, you know, find it any way other than you had to go exactly to the right URL and directory, and you found the badly worded English website telling you how to rent it. And you could rent this thing for 16 hours for like $400. And, you know, they claimed they had a 500,000 zombies that you could rent for 16 hours to send your mail. I don't know if it would do something else. They were advertising it specifically for mailing. But I know that case that we were working on, we were seeing they were actually not sending the mail through that link. There was some middleman that was actually sending the mail. They were selling stolen internet accounts, and they were using the botnet to register online for internet accounts with an ISP. They had an infinite stream of actual credit card numbers and names and enough information to pass the limited credit card check, like zip code or house number or some, whatever it was that was being run. And they were registering accounts at the rate of 10 to 15 per second with the botnet, and then taking those accounts and using them to spam, because it was an ISP. It was a U.S. ISP, and that ISP, other ISPs are reluctant to blacklist or shut down traffic, email traffic from another major ISP, because what will happen is the abuse departments will get into a pissing contest and shut each other down, and now 10,000 customers are calling saying that, you know, their photos of their kid's birthday party got bounced back. So, so not expensive. Yeah, in the back.
From the perspective of someone selling things online, like internet accounts or something else, what are your best defenses against that kind of behavior?
What do you mean? What's your best defense against?
Say I'm an ISP, or I'm selling some sort of product online, especially a commercial product. I don't want people buying it.
I don't want people buying it through a botnet or using stolen credit cards or something like that, using an automated process. I mean, aside from, you know, putting some scrambled text on it for a user to type in, which I've seen the ads on Craigslist for, write me a program that will defeat this, and they do. I've seen demonstrations of things at work. So I don't want people to do this. How do I prevent it?
It's really hard. I don't know. I mean, I think if you see your volume of sales go through the roof exponentially, where you were selling 500 a day and now you're selling 500 in 5 minutes, you might have a problem. I mean, unless you have the new Tickle Me Elmo or whatever it is. But you know, what we were with that, with the ISP getting the accounts that way, what it was, you know, you're an ISP, you want new customers. You tell them you can sign up for access and get immediate access. You have to give us credit card numbers so that after 30 days we can bill you. But we don't actually bill the credit card for 30 days. So we don't even know that it's a bogus credit card. We don't know if it's been, you know, unless it's already been stopped by whosever credit card it actually is, we're never going to run it. The bank's never going to see that number. We don't, you know, we don't put a hold on any money. And what do we give you? We don't have to ship you anything. We just give you free, you know, we open up an account for you. That's all automated. So it was something that a botnet really, there was a good fit there for it. It was a good fit for, one automated process being used to exploit another automated process. So I don't know. If you're actually selling things, I think it's probably easier to slow things down and have somebody notice there's a problem.
Just to partially answer your question, it really depends on how much business you're doing and what tolerance you have, what insurance you have against losses due to risk. There are ways of screening for fraud, generally, with purchase patterns, and you can outsource that. When I ran a web hosting business much smaller than Earthlink, we actually manually reviewed every order, and if anything, just gut reaction of the screener was wrong, the order was paused until phone verification with the number that was given to us, and you would be surprised because you would have someone's name, address, correct phone number, and credit card, but they weren't the one ordering an account. Their information was just being submitted to you to open the account. So you'd call them up and they'd have no idea who you were. And usually with those calls, it'd be like, hey, I'm calling you to verify your account that was placed with American Express card ending in these numbers. And usually people get a little freaked when you are telling them, and they also know you're not like a scamster yourself.
And that stuff right there, you know, what was being used in the case I'm talking about, the information that was being used there, that stuff is cheap these days. I mean, everybody's seen the big bust that was the FBI made of the guy down in Florida with all the stolen identity stuff. That stuff is cheap. It's actually cheaper to buy stolen identity than it is to buy a stolen Warcraft account these days. The Warcraft account actually has a higher street value.
I'd also like to mention that captures the enter the text in this image doesn't always work. I've seen where scammers are actually putting those captures on adult websites for people to enter to get access to the adult content. So they're having basically like Amazon's Mechanical Turk, they're having a bunch of people solve these captures for them, and you cannot defeat that.
Yeah, that's the smart way to do it. They put they use humans to do it. They actually give humans something for free to maybe give them they make them think they're getting something for free in order to beat the system. I was reading in the latest DHS report that there's some incredibly low-tech penetration activities going on right now that are becoming more popular. I don't know if anybody saw this one. Laptops have been shipped to the governor's offices in like 20 or 30 states. Just HP laptops just show up brand new in the box. Nobody ordered them. IT departments don't know where they came from. Free laptop. And just hoping, you know, because I know Wyoming and West Virginia, and no offense to anybody from Wyoming or West Virginia, but, you know, those are smaller states, low population states. You know, maybe they're just, somebody's going to open the free laptop and give it to you. And all of a sudden, you know, here goes government information. Small banks are getting, it's not me. Smaller banks are getting sent CDs or DVDs with a letter from the claiming to be from FDIC saying, we've reviewed records and it's been too long since you certified your employees were all trained in certain procedures. Please show these videos to your employees. You know, within 14 days, they'll play on any computer in your office with internet access. And they pop the DVD in, and it doesn't work, surprisingly, because it's not going to show a video. And now you've got financial institutions getting compromised by getting mailed DVDs and a letter telling them to play them. I mean, that's not savvy. That's just silly. So,
I'm just wondering, from a consumer point of view, from an end user point of view, what's the best way to protect yourself from getting infected with the bots? Is it just like spy bot search and destroy, or I mean, any of the commercial ones? What's the best way of doing that?
I don't know that there is necessarily a best way. They are constantly evolving. They are constantly changing to hide themselves, to come up with new versions, and every time one gets put down, to take its place. You know, absolutely, they combine the worst parts of, you know, the Trojan horse, the virus, and the worm all together. So your typical things, your firewall software, your antiviral software, all that kind of stuff, you absolutely want to have that because it's going to catch some of them. It's going to catch a bunch of the amateur ones for sure. If you're an end user, it's really hard. You're not probably going to see a lot of the activity unless you sit there and watch your inbound and outbound traffic logs and know what to look for, because they don't all use the same sorts of protocol for command and control. They don't all use the same. They don't all even do the same things. Lawrence runs, and I'm not, he doesn't sell this, so I'm not giving him free advertising. He runs MyNet Watchman. That's the website, MyNetWatchman.com, and he has an online tool. I have a Windows machine, so I know it works on my machine because I've used it. Where you can go to his website, create an account, and do a thing. It'll run a package that will search you, that will do a snapshot of your machine, a snapshot of all the processes that are running on it, and give you an analysis. And if it spots anything, he will contact you and say, this is what I think you've got, or you might want to try this, and will help you get rid of it. He doesn't charge anything for that. I know he does that because that's how he populates his zoo. Because if he finds something on your machine that he doesn't already have, he wants a copy of it because he wants it on his systems.
But even the snapshots aren't 100% foolproof, yeah, because there are ones that disable for 2 hours every day or 4 hours.
Right.
Or when it sees a certain amount of usage from the end user.
Yeah, and the different mechanisms that are used for command and control. I mean, there's some of them out there that are fairly successful where they're really just sleepers. I mean, they get like one injection of command and then they sit there forever and then they start up on queue and they may never call back in. I mean, those are probably not great ones, or they don't call back in within the time that somebody's watching for it. There's some that are being organized. You probably know about this. There's some that are being organized peer-to-peer, but what it looks to me more like is, you know, the cellular organization that a lot of like terrorist groups use, where there's one command and control for 10 bots, and then it reports back to a different command and control, which is aggregates and so on and so forth. So you can go up the chain a little bit, but you know, how far do you have to go to get to the top, and how many are you killing if you kill the one command and control that you know about?
And the real hard thing about botnets is the people who are actually attacking you are, you know, your grandmother.
Yeah.
It's not some organized criminal or some mercenary group. It's regular, ordinary, everyday people. When you tell them their machine's infected, they go, really? Like my neighbor who was driving home and heard Clark Howard talking about Adaware. So he went online and searched for what he thought he said and pulled down a product called Adware, which actually turned out to be spy software. And by the way, their page looked exactly like Adaware's site. And then he called me and noted that the machine was acting a little squirrely. And when I went and looked, I said, yeah, it's because you're infected. Well, I got the anti-spyware stuff. I said, yeah, but you downloaded the actual spyware. So they're getting very sophisticated. You were mentioning sending laptops. One of the pen tests they did for a bank that they couldn't get into, they tried everything. They tried social engineering. They tried breaking through the firewall. Nothing worked. So what they did is they infected some USB sticks and just dropped them on the sidewalk and in the grass out front. And people picked them up and go, oh, a USB stick. Oh, I could use one of these. And they go on there. And, of course, there's a couple of pictures and, oh, birthday party, whatever. When you click on it, you're infected. Yep. And as soon as they did that, they were Trojan. They were in the system. So the biggest threat is the chair to keyboard interface.
Yep.
Don't mean to flog a dead horse here, but I think you brought up an interesting point, and maybe this is a question geared towards everybody in the room, really, is I'm an independent IT consultant, and I work with a lot of end users that have a very, very low
ability on the computer. And I'm wondering, does anybody have some input on what the best combination of automated systems is, you know, currently, to try and get around these things? I know it's changing all the time. But
we have a team.
I'll let somebody answer that because I'm just a lawyer.
I actually do a little bit of the same kind of thing, and yes, I do have a couple of comments. For people who need Windows, and let's just assume some people currently need Windows, I find a combination of any of the better free antivirus software, so Avast, AVG, Kaspersky, I think, is maybe not. I can't remember
software.
If it's free or not. Antivirus software, they pretty much within 24 to 48 hours catch most of the same things as each other. So one's not so much better than the other as far as that goes. SpyBot is pretty good for getting things off, but it's only for getting things off once you already have them. I found Windows Defender and AVG both work to some degree to keep new things from getting on. Encouraging users to use Firefox and not Internet Explorer helps. Keeping them off Outlook and Outlook Express helps. Telling them about...
Did you say keep users off of Outlook?
Yeah. That's true. That it depends on who your users are. So if your users are corporate, you can't really do that. If your users are a small business that's not on Exchange, then maybe you can.
I'm the one guy in the office that runs Thunderbird. So
I have also actually seen users who use Outlook for everything but mail. And this isn't something I told somebody to do. This is something they were already doing on their own. Another option for home users, for end users, most people nowadays don't really need Windows. Like, my grandmother doesn't need to use Windows. She uses a web browser. So that web browser can run on anything. It can run on Mac. It can run on Linux. The best thing for her would be a computer that pops up with a web browser when you turn it on and doesn't give you any other user interface options. In fact, I think Google's working on something like that. So it's kind of a multifaceted approach depending on who your users are and what they're doing. Another thing, of course, is to tell them, expect that the internet is hostile. You know, if something wants you to run a program or install something or anything but display its content on the web page, you know, don't do it. If you go to a porn site and it says install my free player, no. Well, let's assume that users want porn. you can't tell people don't go to a porn site.
Well,
they will.
Bad guys know you want porn, so that's where they go to give it to.
So which was the best porn site to go to?
My friend bought 4,000 subscriptions in a single month, and I think he still wants porn. So it's not like you can teach your kid not to smoke by making him smoke a whole carton, you know.
I apologize for disagreeing with you on the antivirus, but I'm going to. We do quite a bit. I do quite a bit with Missouri Southern State University and the Joplin Public Library. And one of the things we've found over and over again is certain antivirus programs, not free ones generally, include heuristics that catch some viruses way before other programs would catch them, and even catch viruses that other programs never catch. There's one virus in particular, I can't remember the name off the top of my head, the Panda catches, that AVG, Norton, Kaspersky, and McAfee still don't catch, and it's been months since it's been out there. So it really does depend on what you're encountering. One of the things that we do is if we have somebody who just uses it for web browser, there is there's personal web browser that will allow you to do that. It'll allow you to simply open a web browser as soon as the computer comes up, and you can't do anything else. It won't install programs or do anything of that nature. just a thought.
You could also actually make a internet browsing virtual machine and just do that and then blow away the image every time. Or, you know, something of that sort.
Yeah, there's a product called Sandboxy that allows you to create a virtual environment for an individual application, and so the entire environment goes away when you quit. I think that's a free app, as I recall, for personal use. I work in information security, and we've been playing around with a number of things for a while now that have been extremely successful. The machine I use at home with my daughter and wife, who play with it all the time, and you can imagine it gets infected all the time, hasn't been infected ever, and I've been operating it since about 94. So it's been through several iterations of new builds, but it's never been infected with anything. Part of that was behavioral and training the person to not click on every attachment. Another one was turning off HTML email. Our box only does text email. Now, I did that, with Outlook. Who was saying Outlook is evil the way it comes out of the box, but you can tame the beast. There's a registry hack and a setting you have to do, and then it really does text. That keeps you from catching some things. Use Firefox and get NoScript. Turn it on religiously, and don't just click yes on every site that comes along. Web of Trust, another plugin for Firefox, is a where people go in and rate sites as to whether or not they think they're infected. And then it'll tell you, there's a little green icon, and if you got a site that they think is really evil, it will block you from going to that site if you accidentally click on it. So that's, for instance, when you do a Google search, all the little sites will come up rated. If you type one in the URL, the rating will come up to the side of it. That's another free utility. The biggest thing you can do is change your behavior. Don't just click on everything. Don't assume sites are assume the internet's hostile and they're out to get you because they are. Use antivirus, keep it current. Another thing we've been using is a host block, and essentially what it is, you go in and you populate your host list with known bad sites, and you can continually update that. And what that does is actually points that site back to your own machine. So if you accidentally click on a known bad site, it's not going to go anywhere. It just can't, because it's going to come back to 127.0.0.1, which is you. You're not going to respond. That works actually rather well, and that's free. All you got to do is go get the host list and put it on your machine.
If you're going to do that, don't do it in a corporate environment. Don't do that with individual machines. Do it to DNS. Right?
Any business of any size at all is running some sort of internal DNS, and you can block all of that at the DNS server, so you're not stuck updating 800 machines worth of host lists and not knowing which machine is which version of which host list on which box, because it wasn't up when you pushed your updates. So you can manage all of that through the internal DNS and not through the local host stuff. You can also proxy everything. The other thing is, at a business perspective, in addition to trying to manage the individual machines, you need to manage things at the gateway to the internet. And that, generally speaking, to do that well involves some sort of hardware appliance that's got the bandwidth to handle it.
I also recommend you get a hardware NAT box. NAT is not a security device, okay, just so you know. That's a big religious word. But it does a damn good job of keeping everybody out of your network. Also run a host-based firewall. And disallow everything. If you want to play, where's my laptop? It's over there somewhere. It's got firewall turned on to the nth degree, and I can still play Halo. So it works. Use good passwords. A simple way to do that, it doesn't matter what operating system, but it works on everything. There's a free utility on SourceForge called KeePass, KeePass. It's a password wallet, AES encrypted. Give it a really, really nasty password, or better yet, use a cert to get into it. Keep all your passwords in it. So when your bank asks for a password, you look up the password policy and use the most complex password they'll allow. You use all the character classes. You make it 600 characters long, if that's what they'll let it do, because KeePass will remember it for you and let you cut and paste. Use different user IDs and passwords on every site. If they ask you stupid questions like, what was your favorite pet's name? Today it's chair. For the next site, it'll be microphone.
Yeah, I do that with my mother's maiden name. It's very effective. You get really bizarre.
You get really bizarre things back when you're working on passwords, and you're like, my mother's maiden name is uppercase R, 4, underscore percent, but it works.
And KeePass will let you do it.
And of course, KeePass can let you collect all that information and keep it, so it makes it very easy to log into any site securely. And if they crack one of your passwords, good luck if they do. But if they do, they only get one of your sites, not all of them.
Well, I have a concern with one of your suggestions, and it's not that it's a bad one, but that it isn't something that you can get everyone to implement, which is using a host-based firewall and disallowing everything. I think with that situation, you are back again to the point where users get in the habit of clicking OK to everything that pops up, because every time they want to use something new or different, it's asking them, should I allow this to connect to the internet to this port? OK, now it wants to connect to this other port. Should I allow that? And so on and so forth. And yeah. For me, maybe that's OK. For my grandmother, I can't teach her how to read this dialogue and determine whether that's something that she should say yes to or not. It's hard enough. I've got several non-technical users running desktop Linux where I don't know how many people here use Linux on the desktop or have, but typically if you want to do something a little bit unsafe to the computer, it will pop up and ask you for either the root password or your password, depending on how you have things set up. So the best I've been able to do with regular end users is to say, if something pops up asking for your password and you weren't trying to reconfigure the computer, say no.
And that right there is the real reason, what he was saying about you can run whatever you want. And most of the people in this room, probably not including me, can run these things that will probably maximally protect you and systems that you could administer from getting a bot on them. But most people aren't at the same level as people in this room. And that's the biggest problem. The bots are going to get out there. They're going to get out onto grandma's machine. They're going to get on my wife's machine. They're going to get on, you know. And, I mean, I think that's a fact of life for the future. And, you know, enforcement efforts have to be really targeted at taking down the nets, I think. I mean, as far as the action that can be done on a more systemic and societal level has to be towards taking down the botnets themselves. There has been a lot of that in the last year. The FTC shut down 3 colo locations where there were botnets being command and control being operated out of it. Now, you know, was that effective when they took down Mick Colo, the first one? Spam traffic in the United States dropped between 50% and 75% over the next 24 hours, and then came right back up as two unaffected botnets took up the slack. You know, that's great intelligence for law enforcement and information security people and that, because what they realize at that point is spammers aren't running the botnets. Spammers are leasing botnets. And when big botnet goes down, little botnets move up in the hierarchy and collect the business. The real issue is who's doing it, and can somebody put hands on them? And the answer is, unfortunately, you know, not anybody in this government. Usually, I mean, the good news is from talking to Lawrence that what we are going to be able to continue to do is see things like command and control systems, or at least somewhere up in the chain in command and control, operating out of the United States or North America at least, because the lag times to Ukraine and Russia and Korea and China are not optimal to keeping their clients satisfied. Those microseconds add up. So.
I think that the case has proven that you should always listen to the lawyer in the end. And I think that there's something you said earlier that somebody else chimed in on, and it's about risk mitigation, right? It's about determining I have, you know, a benefit for doing this, but I'm risking myself in this other way. And I don't hear firms or end users talking about risk mitigation. I don't. And we talk about this in terms of it being a solvable problem, and it's not a solvable problem. This will go on ad infinitum. There will be something new. There will be something different. The war will never end. And if you look at it in those terms, then it kind of changes
your perspective about it, especially if you explain it to grandma. We always talk about grandma. It's not necessarily grandma. It's roommates. It's your parents. It's everyone. Okay. My second point is that, or the second thing I have to say is that we talk a lot about how to prevent it, but there's also risk mitigation post fact. Okay. Something that never is brought up in these types of conversations is turning your damn machine off. Is that people leave their machines on, and that's a risk for A, you getting infected, you know, by some Trojan or some worm that's probing you, but also if you are infected, it takes your machine out of that equation. And if your machine can't be attacking something when it's supposed to, it decreases the load by that much. It's just amazing to me that I have friends that work in the security field that leave their machine on because they assume that they're okay because they know about it. It's completely untrue. Please turn your machines off.
Back to the botnets. One thing I was curious about is how often do you see, we've mentioned over and over, botnets being taken over. Where the command and control is here, I believe you mentioned that you all do that on occasion. You take down a botnet, and the computers are out there still trying to communicate with the command and control. That leaves an opening for somebody else to come in, grab those computers, especially since once they know which botnet was running on it, they know which vulnerabilities the machines have just from knowing it's there.
Right.
How do you protect against that when you take down the command and control?
Well, I don't. You know, that's gonna vary. I mean, the bots themselves are so varied in design. You know, some of the bots, shortly after infection, check in, get put on a list, and the command and control, you know, keeps track of where its bots are and activates them when it needs them. Some of them check in periodically. Some of them don't check in at all and wait to get a signal. That then puts them on the list. They're reactive instead of proactive, I guess. So I mean, it's going to vary based on the bot. I mean, yes, there's probably, as these things get taken down, there's probably lots of, you know, dormant or dead bots sitting out there on machines everywhere, just waiting to be turned back on again at some point if somebody, you know, puts the right command and control together. I mean, I don't think that's ever going to go away. As long as they're there.
Well, the bots go looking for, they have a list of pre-encoded IPs they go looking for. So unless you can work in collusion with the DNS operators to route the IP to you, it's kind of hard to steal command and control from them.
Yeah. Some of them. Some of them get, what was it?
Well, sometimes they use a back channel to communicate, right, to send out commands like IRC, and if you can latch onto the IRC channel, you can reprogram where they're talking to.
I've read something in something very recently about these ones that are almost using a shotgun method, just a random, this sort of random CNC network that is, you know, if it works, it would be almost impossible to disrupt because you don't even know. If you catch it checking in one time, you have no idea where it's going to check in or get its orders from the next time. Now, I don't think any of the really successful ones today use anything even remotely like that. But, you know, someone's working on it, and that's scary.
Well, that's actually one of the things is it used to be when you were battling these guys, well, we were talking about our grandmother, or in my case, my mom. She's battling a 14-year-old in some basement somewhere who's bored. Now you're not. You're actually battling a professional programmer hired by the mob. So you're going against some very smart guys with PhDs in computer science.
A mob or a government.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things we've seen working at the university is we go beyond the simple communicates out. We've actually seen computers that will try to communicate with other machines inside the university and never actually hit our outgoing transmission till it's all encrypted with SSL and to the point where we can't always catch it. We actually went to putting pretty much at every switch, at every router, excuse me, we put a firewall, and we firewalled each section of the school off, and it was amazing just how much traffic went out that wasn't legitimate traffic that was going between computers on our network that we would have never seen the way we had it set up where we just had the monitoring all the way out on the internet access point. I'm wondering if, have you seen that inside of?
I mean, that's at a level of, that's at a technical level, and again, I'm just a lawyer. That's at a technical level that's a lot lower than where we get to go. I've always been interested in having university IT departments and that really scream at their state level law enforcement to try and get some action on this kind of stuff. Because I think that that's always been a problem for us working with spam and fraud and abuse on the civil litigation side, is, you know, we have clients, whether they're a big client like an Earthlink or a small client like I represented the Clinton Internet Service of Clinton, Iowa, against a handful of spammers. And, you know, that was a 3-employee company with like 5,000 subscribers. You know, you cannot get police, sheriff, I don't even remember what it's called, the Iowa version of the, you know, Georgia Bureau of Investigation, whatever their state level police authority is, and the FBI. I talked to a guy twice in Des Moines, and he, you know, they're not interested in it. You know, a lot of times that's because they have more important things to do. You know, child kiddie porn is handled by the FBI. That's what they spend a lot of time doing. They're guys who are doing their internet stuff. I'm not so sure what state level. You know, I don't even know if Georgia has a really robust, you know, internet crime, cyber crime department at the GBI level. But those guys would not really probably be handling that stuff. They'd hand off kiddie porn and stuff like that to the feds, because the feds can make people go really away. And you know, if you're the IT department, if you're in an IT department at a university, those are all state computers. If you're a state university, those are all state machines. Those are the government's property. And those people should be out there, you know, you should have an easier time getting law enforcement involved, I would hope, than, you know, a private company would.
Yeah, for here at Georgia Tech, if it becomes a criminal matter, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation gets involved.
Yeah. Oh, I know, my first roommate at Tech, he was doing a little key logging, so they came to my room, and this was back in the late 80s, and they saw I had a Mac, and they weren't interested. They took his computer and they left mine. So, anybody else have anything? Yeah.
There's a lot of demographics that are, let's talk about this in terms of real infections like viruses that we all get, colds, HIV. There's a lot of research done about demographics, about who's infected and how they're infected. Are you aware of any research that's been done about demographics at the very granular level of who's more susceptible to these types of things? Because then you can have campaigns that are targeted towards those demographics to help stop it.
I haven't seen anything. I looked, you know, I found, I'm talking tomorrow on spam, and I did some looking to see, you know, recent spam statistics. I found a lot of that. On botnets, you can find raw numbers about infected bots, and you can find, you know, the $70 billion a year number that's thrown around as the cost of various forms of malware, including bots. But yeah, I haven't seen anything on like who's infected. But, you know, again, if your infected population are either home users or small businesses, which typically don't have an IT department. I mean, I'm my law firm's IT department. So that's not a joke. And one of the other attorneys actually has a computer science degree from Tech, and I have a physics degree, so I really shouldn't be doing this stuff. So, you know, I go by Kapersky when it comes out, and I make sure that the website's password is, you know, 15 characters long and not subject to dictionary attack, and I have to change the web hosting around. But, you know, if we're the problem, it's going to be really hard to get me to deal with the office computers being infected. That's why I keep Lawrence's number handy. So he owes me for my trip to North Dakota that I provided him, so I use that as much as possible. So yeah, I mean, yes, you could make people aware of it, but I think making people aware of it is going to make a lot of people either just going to sail right on over their head if it's my mom or even my wife, or they're going to get paranoid, but I don't know that's going to necessarily have a real effect on it.
I guess my question is actually more leading than that.
Yeah.
I think that we we'd all be very surprised to hear about the demographics involved, that it's a lot more stratified than we think. We always talk in terms of grandma, but it's also us. And yeah. And knowing that, just having that data and being able to say, hey, you like to program, you know a lot about the internet, but you're also very much sure. at risk, and you even contributed to this type of thing.
You're 22, 25, whatever, you know. I can pay my annual subscription fee to whatever virus thing I have or whatever, it's $10 or $12, or I can go get that new copy of, you know, Halo. Which one am I going to do? I know which one I would do, and I'm not 22 or 25, but it's great that there are a lot of free resources out there, but even then, a lot of people are not technically oriented, even if they're smart people. And they're not even going to think about looking for a free, you know, virus scanner, a free, you know, spyware remover of that. But go ahead. Yeah. Oh, sure. Sorry, I didn't see the mic there.
I was just curious if you knew what percentage of spam around nowadays is a result of botnets.
Well, I mean, I'm going to guess it's a pretty high number. I mean, if they took down Mikolo and dropped it in the United States from 50 to 75%, that's probably... It's over that, because that was one or two botnets going down and taking 50 to 75% of the spam. I mean, there are botnets that just spam certain things. I mean, there's one botnet, and all it spams is pharma. Pharma, pharma, pharma all the time. And it's the worst spam ever, because it's, you know, it's got Viagra in the subject line. It's totally ineffective. I mean, which ISP's mail servers aren't just trashing that stuff by the boatload?
As far as users, I think that are pretty susceptible. I think it's the semi-technical users. I've got a lot. The ones that come into my office building, as far as if I would guess, if there's a virus coming in, it's probably my programming team that's probably the worst about it. They're out there trying to find some cool new toy that's going to speed their stuff up, and it's free. Well, a lot of times the free little backdoor is also in there. So
yep. A little knowledge is dangerous.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
When might we begin to see this sort of thing on Apple computers? I've always heard, oh, don't worry about it, it's a Mac.
There's, let me see, hold on. There was actually something, because we have, like I said, we have three attorneys in the office. And I have the oldest computer, and Mr. Woodard has a Mac. I have a PC, and he's a Mac evangelist. And he likes to brag about, and I didn't bring the Homeland Security report. He likes to brag about his Mac and how safe it is and all that. And there was actually something in the August 31 Homeland Security report about a new botnet specifically out there targeting people who want to get the early release version of Snow Leopard. Click here for your early release version of Snow Leopard, and there goes your Mac. So.
Yeah, it's the same thing with the somebody put out a pirated version of the iPhone version 3.0 operating system before it actually was released, and it was Trojaned.
Yeah. So, yes. I mean, as their market share grows, so will their susceptibility to this stuff. I mean, I don't know enough about the architecture or the operating system to know how much more robust it is compared to Windows. I mean, I know Windows is riddled with holes like Swiss cheese is. I don't know if Mac doesn't have that reputation because it isn't, or just because it hasn't been looked at, you know, by people with devious minds.
Well, it's rather interesting. At CanSec West, they have a hack to own or whatever contest they do, where guys come in and use 0 days to see who can be the first one to hack into the systems. And the guys who do this professionally, this is what they do for a living, like the Macs because they're so easy to break into. There's an article you can go read on it. This is not my opinion. I read this online. The issue is, though, how many Macs are out there. They sell over 100 million PCs. That's Intel-based. A year. They haven't sold 100 million Macs yet, I don't think.
Yeah.
So when you have 10% of several hundred million computers infected and 10% of Macs are infected, they're getting the same infection rate. It's just that there's so many fewer of them, you don't have as many infections.
One thing I've been curious about with Macs is I know a lot of people who own Macs dealing with the schools, and they say, we aren't infected, but there isn't the antivirus resources. There aren't.
Right.
You really don't know for sure.
whether they're infected, unless you go in and you look at the traffic and you watch for certain activity. And it's very hard with a Mac because it's not as well documented to know what activity to look for. So one of the things I'd like to see is somebody do a, here's how to tell, I realize that it changes all the time, but here are some Mac viruses, because there are some out there,
yeah,
and here's what they do. They're not near as well documented as the ones for Windows. They're not near as easy to get rid of once you know you have it as the ones for Windows. And that is something that I think would be an interesting avenue for somebody to look at.
Yeah. And with things like, you know, your plain old viruses and worms and that, where it's really vandalism, I mean, is the motive. And you're going to probably see a lot more of that with Macs. You're probably not going to see the bots as much as with Macs, simply because of the reason that he said, which is these guys are in it, at least in part, for the money. You know, it's that when there was the attack a couple months ago on there were a couple government departments that were hit with a DDoS attack. Pardon?
North Korea attack.
Yeah, but what did they use? They used the MyDoom bot. You know, that's a bot that's used to send spam. Somebody just, you know, whoever it is, now maybe that's a bot that's run, that maybe that's a spam for hire operation run out of North Korea, or maybe North Korea leased it to do a DDoS. Who knows? I mean, but the folks who put that bot out there are making money from it, even if it does end up getting put to, you know, some at least for them, non-commercial uses as an attack instrument at some point down the road. So, I mean, the money's going to drive it. I mean, it's a profitable, I'm sure it's a profitable operation, because really they, you know, they design a little thing and they send it out there in the world, and then they sit back and collect the royalties from other scumbags.
I'm fairly multi-platform with things that I do. I use Mac, Windows, Linux, not BSD regularly, but I don't think that anything that is intended for end users, so regardless of what the underlying platform is, I don't think anything intended for end users is ever going to be a particularly hardened target. So, for example, on my Linux system here, my home partition is not mounted NoExec. I could download a program and run it as my user account without ever installing it. I could do this by accident or by a malicious program running itself through a flaw in my web browser or something, you know, just like Windows. And no one's attacking it because it's a fairly small target right now. But as it gets more popular, you know, we see netbooks now coming with Linux. You can get a brand new Dell order with Linux, although it's hard to find on their site. You know, Google is going to be pushing this Chrome OS, which is Linux-based. We're seeing more smartphone platforms. I think those are probably going to be botnet targets. As long as it's easy for the user to run software, it's going to be easy to attack with these kind of things. So I tell people right now to run Linux. That's because it's a small target, not because it's inherently more secure. And we do have Mac botnets out there already. There's one called iServices. It's a Trojan. And it is only going to grow as the platform gets more popular, and also as Windows gets harder to attack.
So I was curious. Sorry, apparently I'm a little loud. I was curious whether or not there's anything that we could learn from botnets from a legitimate computing standpoint. Like, they're obviously very good distributed computing platforms, and at least some of us, I'm sure, are interested in the distributed computing from, you know, SETI at Home or the Boink project. So are there any principles or anything like that that we can learn from studying botnets?
I'm going to turn it over to the professor. I hate to sound like a broken record. I'm a lawyer, so you know, yeah. I think I use computers, so yeah. I mean, I think you said, like you said, SETI at Home is a great example of distributed computing. I've got a client that's really trying to do some innovative stuff with cloud computing and that. You know, can things be learned from botnets? Sure, but I think that, you know, a lot of what they're doing is very you know, for lack of a better term, guerrilla, and intended to really hide more than to function. The functionality they require is actually very low. And it's really, you know, the get it in, get it installed, keep it alive, and operate under the radar is really where their mastercraft is. What do you think about it? What can we actually make something productive out of botnets? We round up all the bot masters. We could have a labor colony.
People in research thinking about that. If there's something you could legitimately use it for. The problem is the basic idea behind a botnet is the same thing that SETI at Home does, except SETI at Home, you actually install it yourself. And you did it on purpose. Botnets are the idea that they're going to trick you into installing it against your will and take over resources of your machine. And so if you're talking about doing things along the lines of SETI at Home, those are already very successful. However, if you're going to actually try to commandeer, for instance, for protein folding, 1.8 million machines illegally, that's probably not.
Yeah.
I guess the whole one that would be, since you said their expertise is more so in the silent installation, well then what about from an enterprise computing standpoint of we need to push out software, a lot like you can do through, you know, Microsoft lets you do Active Directory, things like that.
Yeah, we use EPO, SMS, and Linux to do that now. Mm-hmm. So we already have legitimate
mechanisms
doing that.
I'm aware of that, but I was thinking more along the lines, are there better mechanisms that we can learn through how botnets handle that, and it's a problem?
I mean, I think it's a good question, but I mean, and this is, I'm not trying to insult your question at all when I say this. I'm a lawyer, so sometimes when I say things, people get offended. That, you know, it's almost like asking, well, what can we learn about communication from spam? And it's, well, you know, it's email, which we already have. It's just email that's incredibly annoying. So I don't think spammers do anything that really helps the thing. I mean, I think email's probably been improved because of things that have had to be done to stop spammers in, you know, some marginal way, some knock-on effect, if you would, but I don't know.
Well, I'm just going to comment on what you said. I've had discussions with people on that same topic. And the problem with botnets, or one of the problems with what you're looking at as far as something good that can come out of it is, if botnets were perfect or very installed themselves very effectively on computers, most people wouldn't know they had them. The reason that people know their computers are infected is because you get all kinds of results. I mean, they shotgun so many botnets out there that they get enough effective ones working that it serves their purposes. But how many computers lock up, run completely slowly, that the computers are no longer effective? So they do a lot of damage to get the effectiveness of them. And when you've got somebody obscure doing it, they don't care how many computers they messed up, how many systems have to be rebooted, reformatted. If you're trying to use this positively, who's going to take responsibility for the bad installs as your good program attempts to replicate?
Can you give us a general description of the past couple of cases you've been involved with?
The ones that involve bots?
Anything technical.
Anything technical.
Well, I guess, yeah.
The last big bot one was this one with these account registrations to do the porn spam. And that was probably 2007. That was the last time where we were actually in civil litigation where there was a botnet involved. The most recent things, you know, I had one that went to trial on a DNS hacking case, and that's what was in North Dakota, which was a little ridiculous trying to convince a state court judge or discuss it with a state court judge in North Dakota what security procedures on a DNS server were appropriate, because there was just it was a language issue that was never going to be resolved. And other than that, mostly some fairly non-technical spam, a lot of fairly non-technical spam cases. I think the most technical thing that I've actually been in litigation on is the DNS one. Like I said, with botnets, you know, we treat them, when we see them in the spam context, we treat them like a spam case, and the botnet part gets handed off, because there's really nothing that a lawyer in this country could do about a botnet, other than warning people.
Yeah,
Now, you were talking earlier about trying to get the CNCs local so that law enforcement can do something about them. And talking about the lag time from China, Korea, etc., that it adds up and so forth. Isn't that kind of like the DEA trying to get heroin production moved to Nebraska?
Yes. I mean, we don't want to move the bot. Well, I mean, if botnets are going to exist, I mean, I guess maybe that's a good analogy. But they're picking their colo sites for command and control here for that reason. I mean, if you want to compare it to coca production, it would be like if your Colombian cartel decided, the cost of importing the cocaine into the United States is the real big problem, so let's just start growing it in Nebraska. I guess if that was the issue, it must not be the issue with the drug stuff.
Going back to your question earlier, I do know of a couple guidance software being the one that comes to mind. Their Encase product, the enterprise version, has a small program that a administrator can install on a machine out on the network to allow them to do a forensic download of the drive while the machine's still functioning and still looks totally legitimate to the end user. So they have done some things with respect to that for legitimate reasons, but I'm not sure, going back to what he said, I'm not sure how much of that you want to do, because you run into that botnets are not 100% effective, and that there are the idea behind security is that when you find a hole, instead of leaving it out there to use it for something later, you fix it.
Yeah. You were saying that's part of Encase.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the folks who use Encase, if it's a civilian using Encase, they need your permission or it's trespass. And if it's not, they need a warrant.
Do it on company computers.
Right. Which they have permission.
And this is the $30,000 version of Encase. This is not $30,000 version. This is not something that most hackers are going to be purchasing.
Yeah.
If they're hackers, I'd imagine they've probably got another base.
I have a question that, as a lawyer, I hope you can answer. How does civil litigation in this space work?
Okay. How does civil litigation in this space work across jurisdiction? So if you find out that the culprit that you have to go after is in Romania or something, clearly if you proceed against him in American court, probably they have no jurisdiction over him.
Right. Well, when you say the culprit, who are you talking about? I mean, usually when we see spam sent through a botnet, if we're tracking, the one we tracked back to Belarus, where you could get on their website. Well, that's where the website was. It had that, whatever the domain for the top level for Belarus is. But, we don't do anything with that. We go, oh, that's cool. Hey, FBI, here you go. You know what to do. You got a U.S. attorney somewhere that can go handle this. We're done. Now, as far as the stuff that's being sold through it, those people are typically reachable, and you follow up with them. I mean, it's the same way you do a spam case. You follow the money and you go after where the money is. Not that we recover tons of money when we shut down spammers. It's very rare that somebody harpoons Scott Richter, for example. Usually what the ISP wants is the problem solved. They want the thing shut down. They want their customers to stop complaining. And when it leaves the country, you're right, there's not a whole lot that we can do, I mean, as far as civil litigation goes. If it's command and control that's local, we can, we've had some luck getting the FBI to go in and shut things down. More recent successes with botnets have been in the civil litigation arena, using the FTC to come in and pull the plug on a facility. And then you can also... what we can do is you can go upstream. You can cut off a colo facility. You go to a level 3 or you go to a XO or something, and you go, look at what's coming, look at your customer here, and look at what's going in, and look at what's coming out, and you need to pull the plug on these guys. And they will occasionally do that, or they will cut them back, or they will start asking questions, and all of a sudden those servers disappear. So there are things that can be done on the civil litigation side, but always when there's a target here in the United States. But target has a wide variety of meanings in an internet crime, fraud, tort context.
Yeah, the guy was asking about statistics of demographics of whose machines are infected and comparing that to sexually transmitted diseases, AIDS, things like that. Well, the reason that a lot of that information doesn't exist is when you get sick, you go to a doctor, and a doctor by law is required to report the incident. And so that's how they get the information. How many of you have had your neighbor come to you and say, my machine is really, really slow. I've had it about a year. I'm thinking of buying a new one. Do you want my old one? There's one right there that I got that way. It's sitting under the cart there. Not that particular one, but it's not uncommon for me to get a machine like that, scan it, find over, the worst one had over 800 viruses and spyware installed on this computer, and that's why it was running so slow. It was spending all its time running malware. Once you reinstall the operating system and clean it all up, it ran just like it did a year ago. It looked like a brand new machine. Well, they don't care. They just go buy a new computer. Well, they don't report that to anybody. And even if the repair shop gets it, they're not going to report to any central agency who collects those statistics. So basically, there's no way for us to find out.
And folks in my profession make it worse, because I know when Lawrence will get, he'll get people who use his service, find out that they have a bot, have a problem, cleans it up. The other way he finds people that have these problems is he monitors network traffic. He's on Comcast at his home, and he's watching for certain, he's doing packet flow analysis and that, and he watches a bunch of these captive bots that he's got, and sometimes he can identify an infected user, and he can identify an ISP from the spam that the thing's trying to send, or where, he's catching things that are being sent from bots and identifying it and backtracking it to the machine that it originated from. Well, what's he do at that point? He can't email that person and say, your machine is infected. They're not going to do anything. So he calls their ISP and says, you have a user who's infected. Here's their IP address. Here's the log. Here's this, that. Can you get them to call me? First he tried, can you tell me their name? And of course, because they're afraid of people like me, they say, absolutely not. We're not telling you who our customer is. So then it's, okay, can you contact them and tell them to call me? And they say, no, we don't know who you are, and we're not going to call our user and tell them they've got an infected machine. They could sue us. So you have the smoking gun almost, and you can't even go to the person that's inadvertently firing it off into the internet and try to get them under control. He's had good luck with some of the big residential ISPs. He's gotten good relationships with some of the abuse desk people. He's gone to conferences and met these people, and they know he's not a loon and he's not out there, and they will try. They can always pick up the phone and call their customer. They have that contractual relationship. Hey, we have a problem. We'd like you to talk to this guy who doesn't work for us. And sometimes people say yes and get help, and sometimes they say not quite yes and don't get help. So, yeah.
How do you, one of the things that we do at Missouri Southern is we require, there are about five services in town that we trust to remove viruses. We require people to go to them and come back with a piece of paper saying, hey, this computer is now clean, before we let it back on the network after we encounter something like that. Can ISPs, or are they going to run into legal issues where users are saying, I'm paying for access, it doesn't matter?
That's exactly what they're going to run into. I mean, you subscribe to, I have Charter cable, so I have Charter high speed at home. If all of a sudden I went home and tried to open up my Gmail and I had no internet access, and Charter says, yeah, well, we got a report, there's a problem with your machine, and you got to take it over to wherever and get it certified, even if they're right, I'm going to be cussing the whole way there in the car, and I'm going to be trying to find a new ISP on the way home. So, yeah, I mean, that's the problem. They're all afraid of, especially in this economy, they're all afraid of people looking for alternatives. They can't They can't afford to alienate customers. What they can do is try and do something where when they have a customer that has a problem, find a good way to approach them, find a way to get them help, and do it, you know, call that an extra service. Okay, sure.
One more question?
Sure.
Well, about that, how the ISPs can't shut you down or something like that. I have Bright House down in Florida, and one of my roommates had an infected machine. And one day our modem got shut off because of security things, and we couldn't get it back on for like 2 weeks because it was the second time it happened.
Yeah.
So, that still just stands as we can't complain to them telling it, it's our traffic, so what are you going to do?
Right. Well, I mean, you have the option to vote with your wallet at that point. I mean, I've had that happen here in Atlanta when I lived in a post apartment complex and I had internet service that they had some ISP that they were hooked up with and they shut off my machine for something. And that afternoon I'm on the phone with Bell South trying to get DSL installed. I want my machine cleaned up, sure, but you know, I need my internet.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody.